This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of this year's BFM Health and Living Junior event by AIA Vitality.
Can I just introduce the next session, to vaccinate or not? And to moderate our to vaccinate or not is Lee Chui Lin, presenter-producer of the Evening Edition. And invited onto stage is our speaker, Professor Pascal Allauté, Director, United Nations University International Institute for Global Health.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. Now, before we start, and while we wait for Dr. Zulkifli to come and join us, if I could just ask you all to go to Pigeonhole. We've set up a little poll for you. And I'm just curious to know whether you vaccinate your child. It's a simple yes or no question, just so we kind of get a good gauge. So far, it looks like an overwhelming majority of people vaccinate. Oh, and before we started our conversation, great timing. We're joined by Dr. Zulkifli Ismail, consultant pediatrician and pediatric cardiologist. Okay, so it looks like in the room, 95% of you vaccinate your children. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why we've chosen to tackle this subject today. How widespread is this issue of vaccination refusal? Can we just paint a picture of where we're at?
Okay, I have some slides that I can show you if you want to have a look at the data. Mm-hmm. So that's the vaccine refusal here in the country. And this is data from 2013 to 2017. So you can see the numbers have gone up, those numbers, up to 2016. But somehow for 2017, it's coming down a bit. So we want to see how it's like in 2018. And when you look at why, the next question you're going to ask is obviously why, right? So why people actually refuse to give vaccines? This is all from local, from our Ministry of Health. Now you look at the top most there is on religious grounds, the issue of this halal haram thing on for the Muslims. And then it's the fear of the content, being content having mercury, having aluminium, and whether it's got pork material in it. And there's an increase in a belief in alternative medicine. There's this belief that if you give your breast milk to the baby, it should be okay. Why should I give anything else more than that? So that's the third thing there. And then the influence of internet is not very big in here, as you can see, all right? And then surprisingly, when you look at data from the West, the fear of adverse reactions is actually much higher than it is in this country. So in our country, that's not so much. The belief is in the after death is greater than the fear of adverse reactions.
Right. And for parents who do choose not to vaccinate, what are the implications of that?
Number one, you run the risk of getting the infection. Number two, you may become a focus of infection for other children who may or may not have been vaccinated. If we look at history, then we know that we won't have repeated. Now, this is Edward Jenner. He put this cowpox fluid into the Sarah Nelms, and then she never got it. This was in 1796. Now, this guy was not the first one to do it. He was the first one to describe it, but the Chinese in the 3rd century AD were already doing this sort of inoculation, and they were taking the thing from the smallpox. This is in 3rd century AD, right? The Muslims in Turkey were already doing this in the early 1700s. And the person who actually brought it to UK was actually the wife of the ambassador to Turkey, Lady Montague. So she brought it back, and then this chap took it on and then described it and published it. From that first beginning, then smallpox actually was eradicated in 1980. And we have no more cases of smallpox, right? So it shows the incidence actually coming down after the vaccines have been introduced, right? It's got nothing to do with breastfeeding. Next one. The number of vaccines that have been introduced over the last few years, and you look at the last decade or so, we have had an exponential increase in the number of new vaccines introduced, right? out of sight means out of mind. Now, people don't see these cases anymore. The thing is, we still see some of them. We don't see any more crippled polio patients. My best friend in school had polio, right? And I used to help him carry his bag from his car to my class. And we were there from Standard 1 right up to Form 6. And we went to university. He did economics. I did medicine. He became much richer than me. And we don't see those cases now. We don't see any more smallpox. We don't see. So because we don't see, we think we don't need the vaccine. Right? So that's the danger here.
Professor Alate, would you agree with that, that there is perhaps some degree of complacency in terms of communities who haven't been exposed to these illnesses because of vaccines?
Absolutely. I agree with everything that Dato has said to date. It is, I think, with the issue of vaccination, there's two major things we need to look at. We need to look at the immunization of the individual and the protection of the individual. But ultimately, with infectious diseases, it is about the idea of contagion, that if you have the infection, you can spread it to others. So the more people who are vaccinated, the more safe the whole of the community is, which we describe as herd immunity. And if we don't retain that immunity within the population, it puts others at risk. The really good example of smallpox, for instance, it is because we achieve such high immunization rates that the agent is no longer in the community because it can't be spread. If we do become complacent, then we open ourselves, we leave ourselves open to being further infected.
In that video that we watched earlier, we heard one of the parents say that he believes in vaccinating when necessary. What are your thoughts? Do you have to get every vaccine available, or is being selective good or preferable? How does that work?
I would suggest that the selectivity may be relevant with the particular disease. There is, from the WHO's perspective and through international health regulations, there are a number of most countries have a standardized immunization schedule. This means that there are a number of vaccines that have to be a part of what parents give to their children. There are countries where the child is not allowed in school if they haven't had these critical immunizations. And then there are a few others where there may be an issue of choice with chickenpox, for instance, which is often if there is a sudden outbreak that parents may or may not decide, or the ministries of health then have a policy that try to roll it out. But there are a standard set of vaccines that all children should have in terms of protection to reduce mortality rates, particularly for the under fives.
You know, it's difficult for you to say that you want to give the vaccine as required because you won't know what your child is going to get infected with, right? If you say, I don't want to give MMR for my child, say, and there's a measles outbreak. And in fact, there is an increase in measles in Malaysia at the moment. And, you know, your child is not protected. Or you decide you don't want to give the triple DTP, polio and all that, right? And there's a child who comes in with pertussis, or whooping cough, and the child gets whooping cough. Now, so you won't know. So the thing is, when WHO and when the country tells you that these are the vaccines that are required, there's a reason why those are. Because number one, the diseases are severe, or the repercussions of the diseases are severe. Number two, it spreads very easily. And number three, it can be controlled. So with using the vaccine. So that's the reason why certain vaccines are actually considered mandatory, and then the other vaccines are not so required, not because they're not necessary, but because the country cannot afford to actually pay for the vaccines to be given to the public. Not because, you know, the government is doing it because it's concerned for the public, and it's concerned for its own people, because if you have an outbreak and if you have a vaccination uptake that is less than 95%, you don't have the what we call the herd immunity to protect the whole population. So we need to have that for 95%. In fact, in 2006, the Ministry of Health was in a state of near panic because the uptake went down to 90%. And in 2007, it went to 90%. Now, that's for us, that's a big deal. You know, for some other countries, I mean, like Pakistan, they're happy with 60%. But we're not happy with that, because if you have that kind of drop, then we don't want to see a further drop after that. So, and then when you have that drop, you don't have that herd immunity anymore.
We've got a question from Pigeonhole. Is it necessary to give the child a varicella vaccine?
To me, if you want to give your child proper vaccination, it is necessary, because if you get varicella, you can not only just get the complications of chickenpox, you can also get shingles, all right? The chickenpox virus will infect you, and once you clear it of the infection, it will stay within the nerve endings, and then you can get reactivated when you're weakened in your old age. So, and you don't want to have that, because shingles is very painful. So, yes, I think you should get yourself vaccinated if price is not an issue, all right? And if you get vaccinated, don't expect the child doesn't get chickenpox. He may get it, but if a child who's not vaccinated will get 100 to 200 spots, he'll probably get 10, okay? So that's the difference.
If I could go back to the percentages, the reason why that's important, because when I've had discussions with others, they've said, well, if we don't expect 100%, then it's okay for me to be in the 5% or the, you know, 8% that don't. And the reason that it tends not to be 100% is that there will be some children who, for various reasons, will have problems with the immunization, if they're immunocompromised in some way and so on. So there is some expectation that there would be medical reasons why some children may not be vaccinated, but this is rare. And it is, in fact, because of, or partly because of those children, that it is so important that we retain the herd immunity, because that then protects those who can't, because we get rid of the risk of the exposure to the various viruses and so on that we're trying to protect against.
We'll be back with more from the panel discussion at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior event by AIA Vitality. This is an edited recording of this year's BFM Health and Living Junior event by AIA Vitality.
And while we're talking about that sense of being responsible to a community, another question from Pigeonhole, the most popular one, in fact. Recently, 7 schools in Putrajaya had to be closed due to an outbreak of mumps. Parents are increasingly refusing to vaccinate and exposing them, endangering children and others. What can we do? It's a tough one.
No, that's an easy one. Get yourself vaccinated.
But I suppose, even, I think what people are saying here is that if that percentage doesn't go up, then I might be contributing to that 90, but so long as there's a recalcitrant 5, then there's still going to be some measure of danger in the community.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if you have, if you've been vaccinated, the chances are you will actually be protected from it. I know there was an outbreak of mumps in certain parts of the country, and if you have been given the vaccine, then you're more or less protected. What we can do, or what the ministry can do, is actually go to the schools and vaccinate everybody. That's one way of doing it. It's called an SIA, right? I can't remember what it stands for, but it's SIA, right? It's where they go to the schools and then they give everybody the vaccine. This is what I tell you a story, right? When I was younger, much younger, sometime in 1986, right? It was the only case of diphtheria I ever saw. Right? And we did not make the diagnosis because we never thought we'd see a case of diphtheria. There's this boy who came, who was breathing like that, all right? And then, and the consultant came and did rounds in the night, and then he said, can this be diphtheria? And sure enough, when we did swab, it was diphtheria. And this child came from the religious group, Arkam group, at that time. Some of you may have heard of it. And they don't give vaccines to all the children there. So what happened was, when we informed this to Ministry of Health went out to the community, got everybody and gave everybody the vaccine and gave everybody the antibiotic. Because otherwise, we would have more deaths from that village. The child, she died, you know. So this is the thing. And these are things that we don't see anymore. I had an interesting conversation because our current Prime Minister's wife, Tun Siti Asmah, now, I did an interview with her. You can actually look on YouTube and look under IFL, Immunize for Life. That's the program I ran. And to my surprise, she said when she first graduated in 1955 or something, and then she went to Hospital Kuala Lumpur, her first posting, the children's ward, half of the ward were all children with diphtheria, the other half were all children with tuberculosis. And the diphtheria ones all had what we call tracheostomy. And she was very good at doing tracheostomy. Now imagine, I have never done a tracheostomy in a real patient. All right? But she's done on children, many of them, because that was a necessity at the time. Because without the tracheostomy, the child would have died. I mean, I was intrigued by it because, you know, I've never done a tracheostomy. She's done so many in her lifetime. And then she was giving the TB medication through the spine, you know, which was what was done before. So, you know, we've come a long way, but we shouldn't be taking all this for granted. And that's what's happening now, and that's what's happening with the anti-vaccine group. They're saying that, you know, vaccine's not required anymore.
If I can go back to the question, what can we do about it? I'd like to be slightly provocative and say that as a public health person, and in spite of being a very strong human rights proponent, I still think that this is vaccination in particular, because it is about protecting the population, is one of the really good areas in which heavy-handed policy is one that is required. Malaysia, like many other countries, signs up to the International Health Regulation, which holds countries legally responsible for protecting against infectious diseases. These are diseases that will cross our borders. You know, they don't know borders. So if we don't, as a population, as a planet, make sure that we have ways in which we can protect the populations, we can, I mean, we just need to go back to the history of, I really liked your historical presentation, but the plague and conditions like that. We've come a long way from that, but if we don't have the policies that actually seriously encourage people to vaccinate, to maintain this protection, we will put ourselves at risk. So it's absolutely an area where I would heavily support, and the evidence supports having policies, for instance, where the very strong incentive is to make sure that children are vaccinated before they go into school, or places like Australia, for instance, will tie parental benefits for their children to immunization just to make sure that all the policy pushes that we can help support parents to make the right decision.
Are there any questions from the floor at this point?
Hi, my name is Shagufta. I have a son who is autistic. He's 10 now. And he was diagnosed after giving his MMR vaccine, he started to regress. So being a doctor myself, I was still very worried about my next son. So I gave him all the vaccines, but I did not give him MMR. And he will be 5 this year. And I had this own hypothesis in mind that till the age of 5, when his brain development will be okay, then I will give him booster doses for all the viral vaccines that I did not give it to him. So doing this, is it okay? What are your thoughts about it?
All right, so what you're saying, is it okay to give the vaccine a bit later? Yeah, that's okay. The only problem is you want to protect them as early as possible. And the earliest that's recommended for MMR is actually 1 year old. Although we are giving now at 9 months, the first dose at 9 months, as of 2016, because when we looked at the data of when we had the outbreak in 2012, a lot of the cases actually occurred in children less than a year old. So that's why the Ministry of Health decided that we will move it to 9 months and then 1 year. And that shouldn't be a problem, right? Now, this thing about this association with MMR and autism, a colleague of mine had similar issue with you. The first child had the vaccine and then was found to have autism. Mother blamed the vaccine, of course, right? Then she had a second baby. So she didn't give the vaccine at all, no vaccines at all. And the child actually had severe autism than the first one. So it's just a familial thing. No, autism is something that has so many causes, you cannot attribute it to one thing. I was in the United States the other day, 2 years ago, and I was at the pediatric conference. People were actually protesting across the road. They were protesting about circumcision. So they said circumcision, there were a lot of placards saying that, you know, circumcision is wrong, it causes this, it causes that. And one of the signs that I took, a picture I took of was that 50% of circumcised children have autism. So you can attribute almost anything to autism, right? Now, just as a background, since you brought this up, okay, this is about MMR and autism. It all started from this paper that was published in 1998 in The Lancet, and the author was Dr. Andrew Wakefield, all right? And this Brian Deer was a reporter, a journalist with the Sunday Times. Now, he investigated and found out that this chap lied about the 12 cases that he wrote up. And not only that, he was getting money and inducement from a lawyer to pay for all this so that when it is proven, they can get a class action suit and get money. And who wins? The lawyer wins, all right? Because the lawyer will charge everything. So smart, isn't it? So and that's making use of medical knowledge to act for personal gain. And it's baseless. The association is baseless. It's been already found in numerous countries in Scandinavia, right, in Australia, in the US, in UK. That association is actually baseless. So you don't have to worry about it.
Now, while that is baseless and it's been thoroughly debunked, there is still, and I think you made reference to this earlier, Dr. Zul, the halal-haram issue when it comes to the content of vaccines. So there's a question from Pigeonhole. What have we done to clarify this issue of the halal-haram content of vaccines?
This is a very, very sticky issue. And if there are Muslims in the audience, you will understand what I'm saying, right? But let me try and explain it. The halal haram issue comes from the fact that in some vaccines, you use trypsin, which is an enzyme that comes from the pancreas of the pig. All right, the trypsin is used in the beginning to actually, there are two ways in which the pork comes in. One is trypsin, number two is gelatin, all right, gelatin that's taken from pig as well. Now, when you have the trypsin, the amount that they use is very small. So when you put it into a thing and then you dilute it with whatever amount of fluid, there is something in Islam that says if you have more than two kolas of two pots or tongs or whatever of water to dilute it, it becomes not najis anymore. Okay? All right, the Muslim will understand. Eh? So it doesn't become an issue because it's diluted. People don't understand this. And at the end of it, when you look at the final product has no more porcine material. So this was eloquently put forward by Dr. Yusuf Kardawi, right? He's an Islamic scholar. Now he says, number one, the issue with pork is, it is the partaking of pork, the eating of pork that's an issue, not injecting it, right? If you're still not satisfied with that, it is also the amount, the small amount diluted with such a big amount of diluent, there's no more, there's not an issue. Number three, biotransformation. Whatever you've put in there, at the end of it, the end product has no more porcine material. You do a PCR on it, there is no pork in the product, right? So there is no issue. I had a problem trying to give before, because before I understood all of this, I actually hesitated to give an oral vaccine, right? Because it had trypsin in it. But after I did all this reading, and after I talked to people, and also after I actually asked the company to do an assay on the final product and tell me that there is no porcine material. And she came back to me after a year that showed that there is no porcine material in the vaccine. It's a non-issue, but people want to make it big. You can make it big. You can say anything is haram, all right? Even our fatwa here, the local fatwa here, will not say that it is halal because of this issue. So we're actually in the process of trying to convince them otherwise.
There are a couple of questions on Pigeonhole that hone in on specific vaccines, so I thought we'd group them together. So people want to know about the HPV vaccine, especially for children and the controversy surrounding that. Let's start with that.
So HPV is to the human papillomavirus. This is the vaccine that is to prevent cervical cancer. Surprisingly, Malaysia stands out as a beacon as one of the countries that has the highest HPV vaccination rates. It was a campaign that was done largely through the schools and so on. Again, it provides a really nice example of the idea of herd immunity, because if there are enough, at the moment it is, I believe it is just in, within Malaysia, it is just girls that are being vaccinated, is that right? There are other countries that are beginning to look at boys as well, but just the vaccination of girls alone, if you achieve a high enough rate across the population, means that you totally reduce the transmission. And the critical thing is that these are conditions that are contagious, so from one person to the other. Once you get rid of the disease within the person, then the population is safer because it's not around to be moved around, to be moved from one person to the other. When it was first introduced, one of the challenges was, well, because it is essentially, you're talking about a sexually transmissible infection, that once girls are immunized, that makes them promiscuous. But this has in fact been found not to be the case. And the benefit of reducing cervical cancer has outweighed those sorts of concerns.
Malaysia's uptake of HPV is actually the highest in the world.
Yeah.
It's more than 95%. And the reason why it's so is because this is handled by school health. All right? And the controversies are actually not that serious. It's just that the initial ones were that they were saying that if you give the vaccine, you're encouraging promiscuity in girls, all right? Which is ridiculous. The other one was, of course, when you give the vaccine, some children tend to faint and have some minor reactions, right? But those are non-issues. And it is true that we actually have the highest in the world, because even Australia cannot come up to 90% in HPV.
And moving on to a question about the pneumococcal virus, is it possible for the pneumococcal vaccine to be included in the government's immunization program because the price is very high if you do it at private clinics? So an issue of cost here.
We have been trying to tell the government to get pneumococcal vaccine in the program for the last 8 years or so. We even went to the point of getting signatures from people, 10,000 signatures, and brought the whole lot to the previous Minister of Health. Of course, nothing happened. Now, if you look at the manifesto of this current government, one of it actually says that they will introduce pneumococcal vaccine. All right? So we hope that that will come true. The last time I met the Deputy Minister of Health and I asked him, he says that we have to sort out the money first. And I agree, we have a problem with money. So if we have the money, I'm sure the government will do it. And I'm sure that this current government, sorry, I'm not being political here, but I'm sure that the current government is very sincere in trying to make it better for all of us, right? And once the vaccine actually comes into the EPI, or the Expanded Program Immunization in the country, we will see the price drop. And the price that the companies will offer to the government anyway will not be the price that they offer to you or me. It will be much lower, all right? It will be at procurement. So, yes, I see it being introduced in the country. We have to sort out the money first, all right?
Another question that's come in is about the flu vaccine. So it's actually two-pronged. One person wants to know, should the flu vaccine be given to kids? But someone else wanted to know, is it good advice for older people, say above 60 years, to take the flu vaccine? So just an overview.
I'll answer the second one first. For older people, yes, you are at risk of getting influenza. You're also at risk of getting pneumococcal disease. So if you're old, you're above 60, I qualify. Then you should get the pneumococcal vaccine, you should get the flu vaccine. Now for children, it's recommended for children above the age of 6 months. Now if you notice, we never mentioned about flu before, right? We did not tell people to get the flu vaccine, but we are telling them to get it now because of this outbreak, because of travel. Right? In the past, we never thought that, you know, it's always a problem with the United States in winter. It's a problem with UK in the winter. It's a problem with Australia in winter. We don't have winters. So, and then when we looked at the data, we see that we actually have flu outbreaks. And then everybody's traveling everywhere and bringing back the virus. So now we tell our parents and patients that we actually recommend it, because right now in the ward, where I just finished work just now, there are 3 patients with influenza, right? 2 of them influenza A, 1 with influenza B, 1 with severe pneumonia. So it's with us. So if you ask me, should we get it or not? Yes, you should get it if money is not a problem, because the vaccine will have to be given on a yearly basis. And by the way, for us, as healthcare workers, I've been giving myself the flu vaccine for the last decade or so, because we are at high risk. So if you see me living up to this age, shouldn't be a problem, right?
I wanted to talk a little bit about messaging, like the positive messaging of being an above 60-year-old doctor giving himself flu vaccines. Some pediatricians abroad have chosen to do things like fire families for refusing to vaccinate their children. What's your take on that? Should there be a softer approach? Should there be a harder approach? Is firing a family appropriate? I mean, where do we stand?
Choosing not to treat?
So some pediatricians have chosen not to treat families if they refuse to vaccinate their children.
Oh, that's pretty harsh. Having said it, you know, you need to be fairly robust in recommending. Refusing to treat, I think, is probably a little hard as well. But having said that, I think that with the issue of messaging is one of the things that I think is critically important, particularly with preventive health strategies like vaccination. It is not a single message for everyone. Ultimately, the outcome we want is the same, but people have very different levels of understanding and so on. So you do want to make sure that your message is appropriately targeted with an understanding of the particular target audience that you're talking to. The only time I've heard of a doctor refusing to treat is where they have tried to provide the right messages and you have a particularly recalcitrant family that knows all the risks and knows possibly that their child is putting other children at risk, and that notwithstanding is refusing to immunize. Having said that, withdrawal of treatment is fairly harsh. I think at the policy level, what governments can do in terms of trying to ensure public health is quite different. I think for a doctor on a one-to-one basis, that is professionally, that might be a little bit of a challenging message to deliver.
Yeah, Dr. Zul, I wanted to hear from you in terms of how you communicate with patients who maybe are a little bit resistant or a little bit negative towards the concept of vaccination.
Well, when I teach, when I talk to people, there are 3 groups of people that you have to know. These are, the first one is the ones who will want the vaccine anyway, right? So you don't have to worry about those, they will come to you anyway. The other extreme is the ones who will not take your vaccine, whatever you tell them, right? And then there's the one in between. The ones in between are divided into 2, one that's been exposed to anti-vaccine and the other's not been exposed to anti-vaccines, right? So the approach is basically almost similar. All we do is we tell them about the vaccines. And if they don't want to take it, then most of the time I will tell them, what's the reason that you don't want to take it, right? And then they'll tell me, oh, because I'm scared of autism. And then I'll go through the facts about it. And some of them will say, doctor, this one, is this vaccine necessary? I will tell them, don't ask me whether it's necessary or not, and don't ask me whether you should get it or not. Ask me whether my children and my grandchildren get it or not. So then they're taken aback a bit, and then they say, okay, doctor, do you give or not? So So I said, of course, I've given my grandchildren. I can show you the vaccination schedule. My children and my grandchildren are fully immunized with all the vaccines, including the ones that are not in the schedule. Most of them will say, okay.
We'll be back with more from the panel discussion at the recent BFM Health and Living Junior event by AIA Vitality. This is an edited recording of this year's BFM Health and Living Junior event by AIA Vitality.
A question from Pigeonhole about scars. So one parent wants to know why scars appear with vaccinations. Another parent wants to know if there are no scars, is that okay?
This is with the BCG vaccine. Okay. With the BCG vaccine, you will expect a bit of scarring. There'll be a bit of, because it's a normal reaction of the body to the antigen that's been put in. If you want your daughter to wear a bikini and not have any scars there, then you can do it on the buttock where it's covered by the panty, right? Some people do that. I mean, and if there is no scar, if you go to school and if the school health sees there is no scar, they'll give you a second BCG vaccine.
The scarring is interesting. Well, I'm old enough to have been vaccinated against smallpox, and it was done on my foot. And that's I'm from Ghana originally, and that was the way it was checked in schools. They check on your foot, because it does leave a quite substantial scar.
Ours is a bit more visible. Yeah, yeah. Easier to just pull up. Another question. Recently, more and more vaccines are being developed. Is taking a concoction of vaccines too much for the child's well-being? And might there be unconventional side effects such as personality change?
Okay. I have to phrase this properly. Now, there was a study that looked at all the antigens that you give, right? And the body actually can take more than whatever antigens that you've given, right? Now, in this country, a lot of us actually prefer to give one injection today and then give the next one a month later. If you were born in the United States and you go to see a pediatrician in the United States, you get 3 injections in one go, here, here, and here, all right? It's a baby. So, and we're actually very kind in that we don't give 3 injections in a go. And yet, there's no issue because the body is able to take care of that because whatever the antigens that is in this hall is more than what's in the vaccine, all right? Whatever you are breathing into me now is actually more than all the vaccines that we give to children. So it's not an issue. Is there a second part to it?
The second part was related to personality change.
Oh,
might something like that occur?
Okay, it's not been documented. But personality change is even more prevalent if you let your child spend time on the gadget.
Yeah.
Which is the next issue.
Something that I wanted to get at, because looking at the questions that the hall has been sending in, there is this sense that there's something about vaccinations that are a mystery, you know, that you're not sure exactly what it might do, what it could do. There's a sense of, I don't know what to anticipate. Where do you think that sense of uncertainty stems from when it's something that has, you know, by all measures been clinically tested, it's applied around the world, and yet the questions time and time again seem to come from this place of, I don't know. I mean, it should help, but it could also do something else.
Sorry, I was just going to give an antidote of again from Ghana. When immunization schedules were first introduced, there was this sense, particularly within rural communities, of the white people trying to kill us off, or the and it still is very much an issue with enhancing rural rates as well, about trying to, again, this issue of messaging, trying to explain the notion of an infection and what it does, and therefore why you are. The question is, why do you have to stab me to make me better? It's really just understanding why it is the technology is the way it is. It's a gradual mindset. It's very much about trying to get people to understand, to make it acceptable.
That's true. What Prof said was about this conspiracy theory. It is also among the Muslims, and the thing going around is that it's a Jewish conspiracy to kill off the Muslims. Okay? You know, you laugh at it, but that was something that I personally had to encounter because a patient actually told me that and showed me the website. So what I did was I actually emailed a friend who is from Israel, and I asked him, can you please send me your immunization schedule? And he sent me. And it was more than hours. It's got pneumococcus, got rotavirus, got everything. And then I showed to the patient, this is the Israeli immunization program. If they're going to give it to their children, what do you expect they're going to do to yours? These are the kind of things that sometimes we have to do to convince people to get the vaccine.
Are there any questions from the floor? Last call.
Hi. Actually, this is not a question. It's just a sharing of my personal experience counseling parents that refuse vaccination for their children. So one of my approach of doing that is to ask them, because most of parents that refuse vaccinations are about from my era, the 80s, the 90s, they're born during that time. So I would ask them a question. Your parents provide you with vaccinations. How are you doing now? So if you are protected by the vaccines, why are you refusing vaccines for your children? So that is a way that sometimes I try to trigger them to think and make them realize that, you know, it is not harmful and it's protective to the children as well. Thank you.
Thank you for that. There is a question here that's quite interesting, and it's also related to, I guess, the issue of privacy and consent when it comes to parents making decisions for their children. Can children go to the doctors to get themselves vaccinated if their parents are anti-vaxxers? So, Dr. Zul, if someone were to march into your office today and say, jab me, would you do it?
I've never seen that, but that's the right of the child. And if the child is smart enough to do that, yeah, he should go into university. And I would definitely give the child, but it's no issue.
So there wouldn't need to be, so the child wouldn't have to go with the parent. There's none of that because the patient would be the child. Is that right?
Yeah.
I see. Yeah. Okay. What do you really, really want people to understand about the importance of vaccination? I mean, seems as if we're in a room full of people who do grasp that, but just to drive it home.
I guess my message would be that we have achieved so much over the years in terms of control of infectious diseases, we cannot afford to be complacent. That is an absolutely critical message, and the data on that just keeps coming through. There's just been a recent major outbreak of measles in Italy. Italy's immunization rates have dropped because of a politician who, one of the things that he campaigned on was anti-vaccine. It's so very clearly demonstrated in the higher rates and in fact, a number of deaths of children in Italy. That shouldn't happen in 2018. This is something that we can prevent. We can't afford to be complacent.
Yeah, I would agree with that. We've gone a long way. And for us to set ourselves back a decade, you know, it's a shame. There is this, I think WHO has got the measles eradication elimination program, right? WHO gives this measles elimination thing to countries where if you don't have a single measles for 3 years running and then you declared measles free. Yeah? So Malaysia's been trying to do that, and we've been pushing our target from 2000 to 2003, 2005, 2015. So it's still not within us. Now, countries like Mongolia is already measles free, all right? China apparently is measles free. United States is measles free, but they've got that outbreak that came from outside. So there's no measles going on in the country. So that should be the next target that we should get. Right? There are certain targets we want to get rid of. We've got rid of smallpox. We've got rid of almost got rid of polio. Right? There are only two countries in the world that has polio now, right? And that's Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then, so within the next few years, there'll be no more polio in the whole world. So, you know, the next step would be measles. There's no issue about hesitating to give vaccines to your child. But on the other hand, if you go in and Google vaccines, vaccination, immunization, your first 10, 20 of those things there will actually be anti-vaccine lobbies. Right? So you won't know what you're taking, what you're getting. So I told you I run a program called Immunize for Life. All right, Immunize for Life is actually a program that was initiated by the Ministry of Health because of that drop I told you in 2006, 2007. Right? So the Malaysian Pediatric Association took it up to actually run this program. It's on www.ifl.my. The whole website, and there are a lot of videos there. You can learn a lot of things if you were interested.
I recommend making use of the free Wi-Fi today and watching the video and visiting the website. Thank you both very much for coming in.
This event was presented by AIA, helping Malaysians live healthier, longer, better lives.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.